This is the Last Week in English podcast, summer semester 2019, week 10, with me, Mark Jacob, coming to you from the TU Berg Academy Freiburg. So far on the podcast, we've had guests from almost every continent, but not quite all of them. Just one is missing, and today we're going to put that right. So our guest today was born in Melbourne, Australia, to a Russian mother and a Lebanese father. She spent the first 21 years of her life in Melbourne before living and working in Greece and then Russia. She did her bachelor's degree in English literature, majoring in contemporary Australian poetry, followed by a master's in Russian literature, Russian avant-garde poetics. She completed a summer school at Harvard's prestigious World Literature program, and then an MPhil in aesthetic philosophy, focusing on modernist verse and erotic desire in Anglo-American, Russian, and Arab writers. Her PhD thesis, which she hopes to defend soon, is on the same topic. She's worked as an English teacher for over 15 years, teaching students of all ages and abilities. She's had many articles and poems published in journals all over the world and has organized a number of poetry events. She's currently living in Freiburg, and came here for love, to be with her partner, who is a musician. So, welcome, Angelina.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. So, before we get to talking about what you're doing now, do you think you could just give us a little bit of background?
Sure. So, I was born in the deep heart of Melbourne. As you've already said, I have I'm kind of various extractions, and in some ways I had a very typical Melbournean existence. I lived in this Bayside suburbs, which are seen to be south of the river as opposed to the north of the river, so you have this kind of conflict in one city. I went to government schools. I was always a big reader. I started writing when I was a kid. Funnily enough, I didn't really talk. In fact, I started reading and writing fairly early in my life, but for some reason I didn't want to talk. So people thought I was kind of a mute or dumb or I don't know what, but it took me a while to actually gain confidence with speaking. And I'm not sure if that's because I was kind of brought up with my grandparents for a while, my Russian grandparents, and maybe that had an effect, or maybe just having bad experience at kindergarten. So I was always a big reader, a big writer, and that followed me through. In Australia, that is really not understood. So for example, in my mother's culture, that is a big thing, books, literature. And my whole family fostered that in me. For example, my mother and I, my parents were separated, divorced when I was still a baby. Definitely my mother's culture was a big thing. And even though we didn't have much money, we always had a lot of books and a lot of reading, a lot of fun. And the same with my Russian grandparents. They would, you know, read me Russian classics, translate things. So that was always in my life. And actually in Australian society, that's not really accepted. So I always knew as a kid that I wanted to live somewhere else, and I always wanted to go somewhere else. In my father's culture as well, there's a big emphasis on education. And can't speak for all Lebanese families, of course, but in my father's culture, well, in his, let's say, specific community, poetry is also highly revered. So I guess you could say I'm lucky that, although it's more of a kind of oral tradition in my father's family and in the community, but they also kind of valued what I studied and were supportive, whereas the society itself in Australia doesn't support that. So for example, many times when I was at high school or accelerating, you know, kind of doing these accelerated extra courses in literature, or going to philosophy cafes, or doing creative writing courses and doing all this stuff even as a teen, people in society were not very supportive. So they would say, oh, you're going to study literature, you're going to be a shit kicker, this is Australian English, I'm sorry, okay, guys. you know, you're just going to be a freeloader. You're going to be just, you know, things worse than just saying a bum, just really awful things. Yeah, you're going to live on the welfare, you know, on the welfare system there. Of course, none of that happens. You know, I passed with flying colors. I was working at the same time while I was studying. I was, you know, trying to publish things. I won along the way a few poetry awards and was writing. I was writing art reviews for student newspapers. I was doing voluntary work at a very prestigious Australian journal, which is published via the University of Melbourne. It's called Bianjin. So I was a fiction editor there. I was working on the archives there. So I was doing a lot of things in, you know, what is my world. But I still felt that in Australia, I couldn't progress or develop enough. Also, I wanted to improve my Russian. My Russian was very kind of domestic Russian. So talking, you know, with your grandparents about, I don't know, the weather, what did you eat? But, you know, I didn't feel that being in Australia that, I don't know, for various reasons. So I always knew I was going to leave. And yeah, it was always kind of my dream to kind of try to live in Russia for a while. Maybe not forever, of course. I wanted to have more contact also with my father's culture in Lebanon, which is a lot easier to do when you're in Russia. So, you know, geographically speaking. So that's it, I think. So I was always kind of... But then again, I would like to say, and I'm not sure who'll be listening to this, but I feel that kids of a certain background, you know, they call it the migrant experience. I don't really like the term. There are also terrible terms, WOGs, yeah, and all of these sorts of things in Australian, which I don't like. But when you come from this mixed background and you don't really feel that you belong somewhere, it's not necessarily a problem, but you feel that if you don't want to perhaps assimilate completely in the culture that you were born and grew up in, then it's better just to kind of try other things and be a foreigner even somewhere else. Like when I lived and worked in Greece, I learned Greek. It was a great experience to actually live and be in a place and make friends and make connections and work in a place which is not connected with your parents, which is not connected to where you were born, and you just throw yourself to something completely new. It was kind of liberating almost. You create a new personality, you have a new name, you have a new language, a new identity, and expressions that express something that you've never been able to express before, or you never thought about expressing. So, and I think that my feelings and my ideas about this in some ways are not very unique. I think that I have met over the years, or perhaps even my Russian family or my Lebanese family and certain acquaintances, people who for whatever reason had that kind of, you know, background where their parents were refugees from Cambodia or had fled from Chile or something. And but the kids of those people didn't want to necessarily stay, and they went somewhere else.
Right. So, And so for you, it was a neutral country first, but then you did get to Russia.
Yes, yes. I lived and worked in Greece, and actually I had finished my bachelor, but I hadn't begun my honours thesis. And so I took that year in Greece as I guess, well, in British English you'd say it's a gap year. And in Australian culture, it's not really the done thing as it is in the UK, but people of course do take a break from their studies, and that's what I did. So I took a break, went to live somewhere, you know, went to live in, you know, a beautiful place in the Mediterranean. I was working in a cafe and tutoring at the same time. I was, of course, you know, I was connected with English, and I had some uni students I was tutoring and things like this, and proofreading a few things. So it was all manageable. It was all workable. And so then, and during that year, I was in contact with a few professors. I was actually kind of debating about what I should write about. Should I write about the grotesque and romanticism, or should I write about you know, psychotic kind of migrant voice and dramatic monologues and contemporary Australian poetry, which is what I decided on the end. So then I did go back to Australia. I wrote it, finished it, and then I left. Yeah, and I went to Russia, and I had found work before I left. And
Okay. Do you think that year in Greece then, how did that influence you? And did that influence
my time in Greece?
Yeah,
it did. I have very good connections still with those people, friends, former colleagues. And it really made me appreciate certain things, which I really believe I hadn't appreciated mm-hmm. before that. And it really gave me an insight into maybe new forms of expression. For example, I love Frembetika. It's folk. It's like basically the Greek blues. You could mm-hmm. say it's kind of the Ottoman blues.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a mixture again of Byzantine, Arabic, Turkish folk rhythms and chants and songs and instruments. And, you know, it's the language of the underworld. Mm. And that for me, I found a lot of things in Greece, which also, funnily enough, spoke to me in the sense of it is an amalgamation of, Lebanese, you know, the Arabic culture, mm. the Ottoman culture, the shared Ottoman culture, but at the same time, Orthodox.
Mm.
Russian culture, because actually where I lived mm-hmm. in Greece, in Messenia Mani, certain monasteries there, they had works by Russian artists. So obviously at some moment in time, during Ottoman times, they were commissioned actually, I guess, by the church, maybe secretly, I don't know, of course, all those details, but they painted glorious things in those, you know, tiny microscopic, minuscule churches somewhere on some godforsaken rock about to fall off a cliff. Very dramatic, very wild. Mm. And so I could see that this is a place that kind of has a kind of crossroads,
mm.
which includes those cultures that are kind of close to me. And it's an interesting mix of that. And even the things in Greek culture, which are not an amalgamation of those things, were still also fascinating to me. But I just found that, oh, this is a kind of crossroads. This is kind of where these elements intermingled over centuries of, human interaction and engagement, whether it's on an artistic level or on a day-to-day level in terms of language or something. And certain practices. So that really, Greece really made me think about that differently and exposed me to that. Actually, I should be honest. It exposed me to that because I think if I hadn't lived there, of course, I knew about that theoretically from books, you know, certain parts of Turkey, certain parts of Spain, where you also have these kind of really, we now think that these cultures were so different, but actually in those places at certain times, or even parts of the Middle East, you know, you had this amazing mosaic of major civilizations and cultures coming together and creating something new from that. But we tend to forget that. So for me, in Australia, maybe the diaspora has kind of separated everything. Whereas in Greece, I kind of felt that it actually was all kind of a mishmash, hodgepodge.
Mm.
And yeah, that was just fantastic. It was just magical.
Mm. Right. Wow.
Mm.
And then afterwards, when you'd finished your honours mm-hmm. thesis, then mm-hmm. did you go to Russia straight away?
Yeah, I did a bit of travelling on the way. But yes, I made sure that I got a job first. Yeah, I applied for work and had interviews. And finally, one school in Moscow said, yes, we'll hire you. You know, I had to go through, of course, there's certain administrative bureaucratic process mm-hmm. in order to do that. But I did manage to do it at the same time. I was traveling a bit through parts of North Africa and the Middle East. And yeah, then I went to Moscow, did a bit of a training there, started working there. And then I was transferred to St. Petersburg and I lived there for 13 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Working as an English teacher.
Officially, right? Yes.
Officially.
Because it's Russia. So that's how I was sponsored. Because although I'm half Russian, my family fled Soviet Union. They were Soviet subjects who actually fled to China. So they were still Soviet subjects in China. But yes, it's a kind of a contentious point. Legally, I can get citizenship, but it's very difficult.
Mm.
Some documents I can actually verify my Russianness, even from the Russian Imperial Empire. We have some documents in the family, but there are certain there's just certain documents they want that I can't provide. But I was thinking of doing that, but it was just actually easier to live there on a sponsored visa from a school or a company. So that's what I did. But it wasn't my main source of income always, and it wasn't my main source of inspiration. Sometimes it was, depending on what I was teaching, of
course. Okay.
Which you might also have questions about.
Yeah. So... Yeah, but other than teaching, then you're also continuing with your academic work. Is that right?
Yeah. Actually, at first, my dream was to do my master's in Russia, and I had actually entered a master's program at St. Petersburg State University in the what they call the philological department, so philological studies. But I had it, so the university accepted me, documents, bit of money, but the faculty had problems with my research and I just got annoyed and I didn't want to change anything. Perhaps I was somewhat headed or too proud, but I also found them to be quite arrogant too. And so then I dropped out and I was very disappointed. I was trying to see how I could be true to my idea, but at the same time still live in Russia. And I was in I was corresponding with some of my former professors, and just out of the blue I remember asking one professor, do you think there are any programs between, and actually there are some programs between St. Petersburg State University and I think Monash University, or maybe it was Melbourne University. And there's actually a special term, which I'm sorry, I cannot remember for the life of me. It's a French term. When you enter a university program, but you do it at the same time at two different universities in two different parts of the world. I can't remember that name. And actually there is this, but again, it's theoretical. Nobody's actually done. And I tried, but it was just a nightmare. And then one of my former professors said, why don't you just do your master's by research? You'll have to do more work. You'll have to have more publications. You'll have to, but because all the material is in Russia, in Russian, there's really no point for you to live in Australia anyway. So I'm sure we can kind of get around a few things. I'll be your supervisor. And that's actually what happened. I was not given any student allowance or something. So I was not funded in the sense of, I probably, this is terrible to admit this. I'm sorry, because you're all students, but I probably have a bit of a HEX debt. It's a government debt you have. It's quite minimal, maybe a few thousand Australian dollars, but I was not supported in the sense of, you know, I had still had to work full time in Russia in order to support myself. And at the same time, I was not only doing research independently, the university did give me a bit of a travel allowance. So I went to Astrakhan for research. It's a city in southern Russia on the Caspian Sea, because the museum with all the archives that I needed are there. And I also went to Iran for research because I was writing about the Persian poems of a particular Russian poet. So... And for a few conferences where I gave papers and everything, international conferences, they also, I think, paid for half. So that's it. Everything else was on me. But I did it. Although I think, if I remember correctly, one chapter had been lost or stolen in Istanbul. So I had to take 6 extra months anyway, because that was the only... I'm so stupid, the things you do when you're young. But I didn't have a copy of what had... It was just, so anyway, I had to get... Yeah, insane. I had to get an extra 6 months for that. But I did finish it. And at the same time, I was teaching English. I had baby genius classes. I was teaching for BECCS exams. I was teaching, even for a while, illegally at St. Petersburg State University at the journalism faculty. I was teaching, actually, and getting my money in a very strange way and under somebody else's name. And because in Russia, you're not supposed to work. Actually, in Germany, I believe it's the same thing. If you're sponsored by a place, you're not supposed to work at another place, I guess. So, but in Russia, it's all kind of rather laissez-faire and a bit more lenient. I was teaching there. And then I was also at the same time, I was going to, you know, poetry events as I, you know, used to do back in the day in Australia. And I realized that some things were not doing it for me. And some friends and I were talking about it, like, why don't we do our own poetry events? Mm-hmm. And so we started to do that. So we would write kind of a manifesto, and we would do mm-hmm. poetry events, not just with poets, but there would always be some kind of interaction with other mm-hmm. disciplines. So maybe we'd get, you know, artists and poets together, or dancers and poets, mm-hmm. and doing crazy things like the dancers trying to, you know, bring movement to the poem, you know, and they would rehearse and choreograph things, and or, you know, painters writing on the poet's body as they're reading, you know, all sorts of crazy different art galleries and all sorts of manifestos. And some things were actually, well, sometimes you just break even, sometimes you didn't make much money, but it was a very bohemian time and very, very creative. Sometimes even poetry readings in other languages, mm-hmm. in foreign tongues. People would read in Tajik, in Farsi, in Spanish, in some minority languages of modern Russia. Mm-hmm. So that was really, fascinating time as well. But eventually I gave it up because you get tired kind of balancing the egos of artists and poets and dancers. Yeah, and I just wanted to write more academically and also, you know, and poetry. So, yeah.
Right. Mm. I mentioned in the introduction that you've published articles mm-hmm. and poetry. Is the poetry that you write similar to what you studied, or is it a different genre?
That's difficult. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Certainly the poetry I've analyzed might kind of, I would say, kick off some mechanism, mm-hmm. maybe in terms of rhythm. You know, you kind of hear a song, mm. i.e. you want to sing it, yeah. In terms of erotic desire, maybe a few. For example, you mentioned my partner. I think I dedicated a poem to him. Mm-hmm. Although, actually, I don't think it was so erotic. Don't tell me. it was published in an American journal, I think, uh-huh. last few years before. But it really depends, mm-hmm. I must say. But obviously, you feel somewhat cathartically schizophrenic, because you do have 1,001 voices in your head when you're writing, or 1,001 rhythms and songs, and, you know, boom 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 from Tsetayeva or something, or some kind of soft soothing things from Arabic, because I also have translated over the years for myself, but also we also had a translating collective for a while in St. Petersburg. We published a couple of books mm-hmm. of our translations, and even a few translations were published in an Australian literary journal. So I guess you hear things or think of things also in other languages or other works, and it does, obviously it inspires your... It triggers something, definitely. Right.
But it's very interesting when you say that reading something in one language could inspire you in a way that reading in your own language maybe doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, for example, my second thesis was on Hlebnikov, a Russian futurist and avant-garde poetics. And definitely there are sounds or experiments that they, I would like to say conducted, mm-hmm. but actually experiments they practiced in their poems, which and these sounds that they performed and practiced in their poems, which just don't exist in English. Mm-hmm. There is no, of course there is avant-garde poetry in English, but just in terms of the sounds, the word, the play with sounds, mm. Just works differently. So, but that has inspired me, mm-hmm. definitely. Although I don't write poetry in Russian, maybe just for somebody's birthday, but not right.
So you write mainly in English then?
Poetry in English, a few times, but nothing published in Russian. I had a blog in Russian for a while. Mm-hmm. I've wrote my thesis. My PhD is in Russian, my MPhil, some publications in Russian, academic publications. But No, I have had things published in Arabic, but they were translated for me when I was writing for a while, just occasionally for a Lebanese newspaper, Al-Bina, reviews on Russian literature. I did an interview for a Lebanese writer in London, things like this, just art and culture. But they would translate my works for me. I do write in Arabic, and I have friends who correct it, kind of to keep up the language and everything, because I didn't grow up with my father, so Arabic came later, actually. Yeah, Russian was more predominant, but yeah, my friends tell me I write philosophical twaddle in Arabic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, somebody said I should probably, I don't think I should ever publish it, but yeah, it's just something for me, for I don't know, brain exercises or something. Right. Not only that, because sometimes with certain members of the family, when I'm in Lebanon, I need to, you know, I want to express my ideas in a more sophisticated manner. Mm. And yeah, it's good when I'm not there to practice that, at least in the written form.
Right.
Because I don't feel that my Arabic is as strong as my Russian, for example.
Right.
Not. Yeah.
And in Russia, then, I mean, then if you're Russian, I mean, if you write a PhD thesis in Russian must be pretty good.
It is, but I mean, I still make some mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of written Russian with, Slovakian, so you know that certain adjectives and their endings in relation to a verb, you know, there can be a different case. And sometimes, you know, I make, you know, I think it's dative case and it's like, you know, it's actually accusative or something, because I forgot, you know. But no, it has to be, I always get somebody to correct it,
right?
But no, I think I speak fluently sometimes, you know. My of course I have an accent in Russian, but yeah, I don't think sometimes in Arabic I just don't know the word, or I stumble for things. But of course, in Arabic I feel more schizophrenic, because you read and write in kind of standard Arabic, the Fusha,
which
is based more on classical Arabic, but actually you speak a dialect.
Right.
So and I've also kind of studied the dialect to a certain extent, so sometimes I kind of mix things up, and I feel sometimes a bit, because when I first used to go to Lebanon or speak with with my own grandmother in Australia, I could understand Lebanese, but I would always answer in the Fusha, which is fine. But then when you are there, people don't, they would prefer you to speak in the dialect. So, right. So I always feel a bit, even until now, a bit caught between the two registers of the language. Yeah.
And in Russia, did you have the feeling then that you were at home there? Because you mentioned that in Australia you felt, oh, you're not quite Australian, and then did you get that feeling in Russia?
No, and it's a good thing, because I understood that with time, well, firstly, I never had any, because I already had experienced the Russian diaspora in Australia, or you know, my, and I knew that I would never be accepted as a forward, and that's fine, because I'm not. And I actually changed my name when I was 17. I had a Russian surname until I was 17 and a half. But even as a teenager growing up in Australia, well, firstly, the name was translated incorrectly, which has bothered me and a few other Russian members of my family who've also changed the way it's spelled, that they've just changed their name. But it bothered me to the extent that I thought, why should I even have a Russian surname? I'm not really Russian. Okay. And I'm not an Arab, and I'm not an Anglo-Australian, I'm not Aboriginal. So actually for a few years I thought about, and I changed my name legally when I was 17 and a half, after thinking about it. And
so what was it originally?
Zoyev. In Zoyev. Russian it should be Zoyeva. But in Arabic, actually, I have the surname Fayad. And I have, my Arab citizenship. I actually have my father's name. So I have various identities and various names, actually. And that's, so I never kind of, I think even before I went to live there, I understood that I wouldn't be. And, but I wanted to experience the country on my own, because I think when you grow up in a diaspora, although I wasn't clinging to the diaspora, I was never like that either. I had friends from, you know, from all over the world. And I'm very critical of my own parents' backgrounds in many ways as well in the diaspora. So I didn't have so many kind of expectations either, but I understood that in the diaspora, from my grandparents or from my cousins or, you know, whoever, I kind of got this secondhand Russia or secondhand Lebanon. And it just really, it was just a nagging feeling that you understand that things there also develop. It's just these people here are living back in, I don't know, some prehistoric Stone Age idea of their culture. And of course, things have changed there. So I wanted to experience it firsthand rather than having just the secondhand, third-hand version.
But you were comfortable with being in Russia and having some Russian heritage, but not being fully Russian.
I was fine with that. And I mean, Russia itself is so mixed anyway. I mean, you know, it's the biggest country in the world. There are so many ethnicities. I mean, even my Russian family is not pure Russian. You know, I have a great grandmother from Ukraine. I have, we have some Jewish blood. We have, I think my grandfather's side, maybe some Mongol Turkic blood. Yeah. So, I mean, Kazakh blood as well. Cossack blood. Yeah. So, from Southern Russia. So, you know, even your Russianness, I think in Russia is always kind of not completely Russian. So I think that's, so you meet people in modern Russia who speak Russian, who are Russian subjects, but I mean, they're Tatar, they're Georgian, they're Jewish, they're Azeri, they're also from the, you know, they're Komi or the Mardavians or from Karelia. And so, where are the Russians in Russia? please don't give this to Putin.
And what about in Lebanon? And because you said you even have a different name in Lebanon. How do you feel in Lebanon?
Maybe in Lebanon, because it's more of a patriotic, it's more of a patriarchal culture. Sorry, Freudian slip. When you tell people that you're, because they hear your accent in Lebanese Arabic, so they'll ask you and you say, yeah, you know, my father's Lebanese, la la la. So people might think, well, yeah, she was born in the West, grew up there, like a lot of Lebanese people, actually. But because your father's Lebanese, it has probably more weight, I would say, in the culture, because you get citizenship because your father is Lebanese. You don't get that if you're a woman, if your mother is Lebanese. It's a big problem, demonstrations about that. So yeah, women cannot give, it's a long political story, but anyway, not very interesting. Very sad, actually, in many ways. Many Lebanese women leave Lebanon also for this reason. If their husband is an Iraqi or Syrian or Palestinian, they cannot, you know, their kids will not have access to certain things because they're not citizens. So it's more expensive, actually, to have a foreign husband as a Lebanese woman. So a lot of them go abroad. Yeah, it's kind of easier. And there are quite a few women like that, unfortunately. So in Lebanon, I would say that maybe because I have more family left there. I mean, in Russia as well, you know, my family, I mean, my great grandparents fled to Kazakhstan, well, because everybody was fleeing from Soviet Union. And then my grandparents are actually born in a Russian community in China. You know, until now, China, for example, a city like Harbin is bilingual. You know, a lot of Russians there. Of course, there were more. Many have fled to the West. So my grandparents were actually Soviet subjects, Russians in China. So in the Soviet Union, the relatives that we had left actually left after the fall of the Soviet Union. Whereas in Lebanon, because I have family there, maybe it makes it more, it makes it different because despite the war and everything, people are still connected to their historical roots in Russia because of Soviet Union. You know, people's historical roots are from all over, and people were, unfortunately, the connection to one's, let's say, land, or it's all kind of tethered and rotting, and it was just annihilated because people were deported in the Soviet Union, whole ethnic groups, and, you know, the camps, and, well, you know, we all know this tragic chapter of Soviet history there. So I would just say that in Lebanon, you know, the families and the clans still have connection to their ancestral like village, whatever, kind of like in
No.
Greece or, you know, Italy or whatever. I'm sure here as well. So yeah, maybe I'm kind of more accepted there. Plus, I have citizenship, so I mean, I can go
Right.
anytime and do whatever I want there. I mean, in Russia, as I said before, theoretically I could, but I can't in practice. So,
Yeah, you mentioned it's a patriarchal society, or how is it
In
then for
some of
yourself being a woman there in
Well,
Lebanon?
oh, you know, that's the thing. I mean, it is patriarchal on one hand, but I think in the so-called West, wherever that is, I think people there are lots of stereotypes about Lebanon. Like my father is a Druze, so that's it's a religious minority in Syria, Lebanon, and Israel. I mean, you know, women are not in the hijab. I mean, actually, in the Druze religion, women are can actually lead prayers, which you don't get with Muslims or Christians, right? So if you think about it, in some ways, our women were much more liberated, and they work, especially if you think about, you know, the olden days. I mean, now I would say with women in the Middle East, well, specifically Lebanon, I'm not going to speak about the whole Middle East, but in some ways have it good, maybe better. Why do I say that? Because some women enjoy being treated like princesses. Some women enjoy not working and having all the services that I think women in the West can only dream about. I wouldn't want to live like that, but there are women in my family or some women I know who want to have the maids and they want to have the kids taken care of and they want to have free time and they want to get them and they want the husband to pay for everything and do everything and they're not so interested in working. But then women who want to work and enter any sphere can. So, I mean, I have many, you know, I have a cousin who teaches yoga, has her own yoga school. I have another cousin who lectures in science, another one who's opening her own business in steel manufacturing. I mean, so another one is an eye doctor, another one is, I mean, so I don't think women are as impoverished as people would like to think in the West, but definitely there are some, and again, whether it's Islamic or Christian, because you know, in Lebanon, there's also, there are many different types of Christian communities there. People usually don't know about this in the West, but yeah, then the community like the Druze, my father's family. Yeah, it's really different. I would say that generally women there, the more educated they are and the more money they have, the more freedom they have. But I think it's like that all over the world. But you have women there who are not married, who have independent businesses, who travel and do whatever they want and don't care what society or family say. And I know women like that there. Of course, in Lebanon, it's probably easier than in a country like Saudi Arabia. But I think Saudi Arabia shouldn't be the template for how we see the Arab world. Saudi Arabia, I would say, is the exception to how most women live in the Arab world. But I just say that from the countries I've been to in the Arab world. But Lebanon, no, I mean, there are some maybe things that I have to talk about in Arabic that I wouldn't have to talk about in English or Russian, you know, about, you know, maybe why I don't want to be married now, or you know, like I would have to constantly explain these things, which maybe in English, you know, you know, people are more relaxed about these things. Family is a big thing there, even if you're not, I mean, you know, keeping the family ties. So the fact that I don't live with my mother or father or don't live close to them, of course, many Arabs live out, but you know, the parents might come to them, you know, and I have cousins like these cousins who live in France or who live in the US, and their parents go and stay with them for like 6 months at a time. It's such a typical Lebanese thing. Whereas, well, my father, though he's Lebanese, he's kind of cool and soft and mellow, you know, he's not so traditional. And so, yeah, you have to explain to them, well, you know, we speak on, you know, Skype every day, Baba and I, you know, my father and I, and it's fine. But yeah, so certain things you have to explain in Arabic as a woman, which maybe you wouldn't have to explain in other cultures so much. But I don't find that Lebanese people are generally speaking, yeah, I wouldn't say that they would force something. But again, it depends on the education background of the family. And yeah, maybe I'm just lucky, or maybe, difficult to say. Yeah, but I don't feel, sometimes I think also patriarchy works for you there, in the sense of, I don't know, let's say this, I want to cross the street. Here, nobody's going to like really stop.
Mm-hmm.
In Lebanon, they do stop for people, but if you're a woman wearing nice clothes, they'll definitely stop for you. Sometimes it's just a matter of convenience to use.
Yeah.
You know, maybe men appreciate beauty more or something. Lebanon has, it was the first country in the world to have a beauty debt. So you can go to the bank, a beauty loan, sorry, so you can go and get a beauty loan. So many women have cosmetic surgery there.
Right.
Kind of sad, but on the other hand, men also, I mean, some of my male cousins really, like the way they groom themselves, and I mean, they take a long time. You know, I've waited and bashed on the door waiting for them to get out. You know, they spend like three times the amount I would spend in the bathroom. So like I said, you know, it's just different.
It sounds like you really, let's say you've really become familiar with your roots. Say you've been many times into Lebanon and to Russia, and you lived there a long time. What about Australia? Where is that with you now?
I don't go often. Firstly, because of time. Maybe money isn't such a factor as time, because if I go there, I can't rest. You know, I have to meet up with people from uni, maybe some former colleagues, old high school friends, primary school friends, and it's just really full on. Last time I was there, you know, you have to catch up with people like four or five times a day. I'm exhausted. Plus my parents live on different sides of Melbourne. They live on two different sides of the bay, Melbourne's. So it's, you know, I'm kind of the, as an adult, when I'm there, I live between two places, and it's just exhausting physically. I come back from Australia every time and I really need a holiday. So I always tell my parents it's easier that we meet up in Lebanon, or we meet up somewhere in Europe or Asia, or you come to stay here with me in Russia or Germany, whatever. Because having said that, of course, I sometimes think about certain things I love there. But I guess with time I also understand there are certain things I love everywhere, that I'm not nostalgic for something there. I don't feel nostalgia because things have changed there. Certain parts of, you know, certain places in Melbourne deeply connected with my childhood don't exist anymore. They were knocked down. Something was put in its place. It became a shopping center, or it became gentrified to this macabre level of over gentrification, basically. And you know, it kind of lost some certain parts that I really have such colorful memories there, you know, as a kid, or they just seem so great now. And you know, I sometimes think maybe it's because I'm getting older. Maybe it was always gray. And so I ask people like, hey, wasn't this there? And didn't they used to do this? And weren't there some like, you know, crazy Polish Jewish cafes, and there were transvestites, and it was this, and the Aboriginals meaning corrupt. And the, yeah, that was all there. You didn't imagine it, but it's all gone. And so that's with time, each time I go back, it's just, it's not the same. And that's okay. I don't feel sad about that. That's normal passage of time. But I guess sometimes I feel more nostalgic about actually epochs that I haven't lived in. You know, like I've been doing research at the moment on, and I'm writing about Andalusia, kind of literary travelogue. And, you know, before that, for my thesis, things about the Abbasid Empire or Middle Ages, you know, British culture, or Scythian culture even. And, you know, you start reading and researching, and like, oh, why can't I go? I feel so missed. Oh, wow. That's just so, that's so progressive, actually. It's so civilized. How can we live it? And so I start to feel very nostalgic for a time or a culture that has no connection with me, you know, in terms of my human biology or my own personal evolution. Yeah, I don't. Yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe I have some former ancestor, some ancestor from, I don't know, Wales, but I doubt it. But who knows? Yeah, maybe some Russian relative there kind of got a bit hot. You know, had a bit of a great rendezvous somewhere in the British Isles, but I doubt it. But I mean, who knows? But yeah, I feel nostalgic about, yeah, I guess literature makes me feel nostalgia more so than, because with Australia or now with Russia, or I know that Lebanon, I know that I can always go back, you know, I know that I can, there are people there, and I can't say I miss a system. Maybe, you know, I miss somebody's kitchen, or I miss having tea with this person, but it's somehow all rectified by my new existence here. You know, you seem to supplement things, you learn to be more malleable, and just kind of you almost feel like and I sometimes Australian animals, funnily enough, yes, Australian man animals come to my head, like, you know, jellyfish is kind of, you know, just around the ocean, you know, the ocean floor kind of. So you feel that you could kind of, you know, camouflage yourself and become a part of this, or live in this space. And there's a certain feeling of flexibility that you can supplement things. And that therefore, to answer your original question, you're not so attached to the place that you grew up in. First, because physically, like I said, it's changed. And then secondly, you just kind of get used to certain things, and things happen in life, as you know, and you're just moving, and everything's so dynamic and full of all these fascinating shifts that we all go through. And obviously, in terms of literature, I do want to return to some of my former research with Australian literature, Australian poetry, and also Australian artists. And I'm thinking in the future, I have been writing a book on and off for some time now, but I'm thinking my third book that I have, you know, notes on, that it will be connected to that. So I guess, yes, in terms of writing, in terms of the plans and projects I have for books, yes, they are connected to each place, actually, Russia, Lebanon, and Australia, but they're kind of imagined, you know, verse novels. One is actually almost finished, but that's actually maybe the way that I keep my connection with, for example, Australia, or with Russia or Lebanon, because also my cultural references in not just those three cultures, but other cultures, whether it's Iranian culture or Greek culture, I'm not sure if they... I mean, I don't want to sound snobbish or like a cultural vulture, but I don't think my cultural reference in Australia are the cultural reference for many Australians. For some, of course. For example, there are also Australian avant-garde artists. They're the Angry Penguins, and certain poets connected with that. For me, that's something that's just a boom. But I don't think most people really get... They may not even know about it. I don't know. But people probably prefer to talk about the cricket or their football team, or their cultural referent might be a certain politician or something, but I don't know, maybe a certain lifestyle choice even. But for me, that's all kind of secondary to the world of literature or art. So, I hope that's answered your question. Yeah.
That leads me on to the next question, which is... the present and your current attachment, let's say, or potential attachment to Freiburg, because now you live here. So do you have to be a jellyfish here in Freiburg, or how is it for you?
I think one has to be, I don't want to say deadly jellyfish, but you have to be a predatorial jellyfish. I only say that because I think... survival in a small town is somewhat different from survival in a big city. So obviously you have to be even more highly skilled in the art of being flexible. And I guess I'm still adapting to things here. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, maybe I'm not happy with myself and I mm-hmm. need to constantly push myself to be better here. Mm-hmm. Because I feel in some ways, maybe I'm a bit lax here still.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to make more of an effort.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in terms of adapting, actually. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's kind of a different test living in a
right.
small town. Yeah. You know, because actually every summer that I spend in Lebanon, for example, I stay in Beirut, but I also stay in my grandparents' village, which is, you know, 30 minutes outside of Beirut. Being in a village, and in Greece, I also lived in a village for a while. Still, a village is not like living in a provincial town. Right. It's something in between, and I still haven't kind of grasped it yet. Yeah. But I think that, yes, one has to be kind of predatory. You have to be more, because it's not a city either. It doesn't have that dynamic in it. It could, but it doesn't. Mm. And so, and plus also, I mean, my pursuits and my interests aren't really, they don't have a place here. So, you know, I'm drawn to Dresden more.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, one must be a bit of a...
And what, I mean, because everywhere else you've been, you've had strong connections. Mm. In Greece, you told me there was that this mixture of different cultures that you were familiar with, and then obviously in Lebanon and Russia. What about Germany or Freiburg? What could be the connection? Yes. Where could you find that connection?
That's a great question, because I always do try to seek those things out, and I have been searching for that, and I have found actually different things that do speak to me here mm-hmm. in terms of my world for literature. For example, there was actually a great conference I went to in Dresden at Mutterhall. I don't know how to pronounce it, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an art space, and I had a 2-3 day conference and also an exhibition of several weeks dedicated to avant-garde poetics in kind of the Eastern Bloc.
Mm.
And well, they also had stuff from modern Russia, but from Eastern Europe, Croatia, Slovakia, Lithuania, Hungary. They had a lot of interesting performances from the late communist era that dealt with, I don't know, sadomaso, shamanic, poetry, anti-communist, all sorts of stuff, amazing. Visual archives they had, and audio, like Vaclav Havel from the Czech Republic, all sorts of amazing things, and of course texts. And there were lectures. Obviously, I didn't understand them because although they said that the day before that they were being in English. Anyway, but what really surprised me, actually, because of course all that stuff I kind of knew, but it was just great to have that connection with it here. That really meant something to me. But they showed short films from Saxony, avant-garde, late communist period, short films, which were also this amazing cocktail, array of dreamy, poetic landscapes mixed with things which, obviously, unfortunately, I don't really understand in the German language. But I didn't really know what to make of it, but it really surprised me. And I was quite astonished that, so of course I know about the Eastern Bloc theoretically, but it was different to be kind of introduced to such works here, because you don't really hear much about it. I'm not sure about Germany in general, but I don't know, I imagine that it's not so, it seemed to be really underground, or maybe minor, or maybe unimportant, I don't know. But that really spoke to me as well, and I became fascinated by that. Also, in terms of, I mentioned, you know, and I mean, even not just Greece, but I mean, like I said, Russia and Lebanon, of course, you have all these mix of cultures. And here in Freiburg, well, I mean, in Saxony, generally in the region, I mean, you have Sorbian. And it's also fascinating when you know a Slavic language, you know, words like Dresden, Leipzig, Chemnitz, these are all Slavic words originally. So kind of reading up on that and looking at, just these kind of interesting, again, this intermingling of something which I kind of understand, but it seems to be something you know, but you don't know, and it's familiar and unfamiliar, and it kind of transforms or mutates in a different, unexpected way. And that's something I have found here, which I read a bit about before I came here, but it didn't seem so important or immediate or close as to me being here. So I'm constantly, oh, look, that's Slavic. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that must have been like, oh, that means. And da, da, da. I think my partner sometimes, he just thought, whatever. It's like, yeah. But it's, I find that this is a cultural reference, which makes me feel that I have, these things make me feel I have a home anywhere, actually. Even if I don't want to make my home in the place, or I can't, for example, in Greece, you know, I knew that I was going to leave at some point, but there is a house where Nikos Kazantzakis started to write Zorba the Greek, for example. And every time I go to this part of it, I always go. It's like my pilgrimage, you know. It's just, you know, and there are parts of Melbourne and parts of in Lebanon and Russia. And so I'm happy that, yeah, I found that here as well. That's kind of my home.
No, that's great. That's great to hear.
Yeah. In terms of other things, I mean, well, the former, you know, Eastern Bloc here and everything, I see some similarities and, you know, I don't know if I should mention it, but reading things about like the Stasi and thinking about the KGB in Russia, well, the FSB now, or the Mukhabarat in Arab world, you know, things like these. So I guess I do see things that are kind of familiar to me, you know, kind of the post-Soviet world, the post-communist world. I think when you travel through Eastern Europe, you do see remnants and traces and ghosts of this. I mean, some of my cousins, they're here now, they've been traveling through, and even as, you know, Lebanese Australians who live in the Middle East who don't know much about the area, but they can see certain buildings or certain aesthetic repeating itself somewhere, a certain mode of behavior. They ask me about certain things, and I think that is something that I also kind of feel I know.
Right.
Whether I like it or not, something else, but I know it. So it's somehow connected.
Do you think that Freiburg could inspire you in some way, or living here to write some poetry? Or...
Maybe. I mean, I've written some poems here. I mean, not about the place so much, or, you know, I don't know if I write that often about places in general, but... Definitely, I feel maybe because I'm also at this strange point in my life where I'm trying to bridge, you know, I'm trying to defend my thesis somewhere and I'm trying to get into the job market here. So I'm kind of between, I feel that here I'm in front, I'm between lives, but for now it's a place where I am being creative. I'm still working a bit online teaching. So I've translated a bit for a couple of project. So I'm not, I do feel that there's a place for me here in terms of being creative for now, being a good foreign citizen, doing my recycling, following the rules. But, well, also, I mean, my partner is a violinist at the theater here, of the orchestra. So I feel that maybe by supporting him at least in what he does here, there's also kind of my connection to the place, obviously, because I moved here because of our relationship. He got a job here, so, you know, I relocated to Freiburg, so that's also very important, I guess.
My
behind every good man is a better woman. I think there's another joke about this. Apparently, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton are driving around the Midwest. They get lost. They ask somebody for directions. The person says to Hillary Clinton, "What would you have done if you weren't married to President of the USA?" And she said, "I'd be the wife of the President of the United States of America." Oh. So, no, of course, Sergei is a great... composer and great musician and violinist. But it's good that he has somebody supporting him like me.
That's great. And any plans for the future?
Well, In terms of my life here, I'm looking for some work,
mm-hmm.
part-time teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I've even considered things like, of course it'd be ideal to teach literary studies,
mm-hmm.
but of course there's not a huge market for that anywhere in the world, let alone here in Freiburg. But I'm looking, of course, in the surrounding areas, Chemnitz, mm-hmm. Dresden. I am thinking of doing something creative in Dresden, actually. Mm. I found a museum, it's a gallery. Kunst und Eros.
Mm.
And I'm thinking that, although I don't speak German, I'm thinking of doing maybe some lecture, some reading there or something, maybe with a musician. So I'm thinking of, kind of how I can keep up some creative endeavors here. While also writing and, there are some projects I have here and obviously for now I see myself doing these things while I'm in Freiburg. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, please keep me informed. Mm-hmm. Keep us informed about what you're doing, because that sounds like it would be very good to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Angeline, for telling us about your international life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that will inspire our students. So thank you very much for that.
Yes, thank you as well.